chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. We're at the JFK Conference in Dallas, Texas, 2017. Being produced by Judith Berry Baker, and to my left is Andrew Craig. He's based in Washington, D.C., is a public affairs commentator, author, attorney, and legal reformer with decades of experience in cutting-edge public policy issues. Welcome to our program, Andrew Craig.
George, it's such a pleasure and honor to be back with you and talk about the secret truths happening and being unveiled here and now.
You get in all kinds of issues over the years, is that right, in the Washington, D.C., and political, and very wide views and issues, is that true?
Well, exactly, and just to set the scene in time and place, my office is on Pennsylvania Avenue in downtown Washington, D.C., halfway between the White House and Congress. To fix it a little more geographically, as I look on Pennsylvania Avenue where they have the inauguration parades, to my right about four blocks is the Trump Hotel where so much is going on, and to my left about four blocks is the federal courthouse where right now the FBI special prosecutor have just presented major indictments just a few weeks ago. That's historically my focus is on current affairs, but we have to know history. We have to know what you would call the secret truths to understand what's going on today elsewhere.
Well, you know, you're right at the heart of the swamp, as Trump described it. I mean, you over the years, you've met quite a few different people, haven't you?
Well, I still do, and I won't get into name dropping, but I've been active in Washington as head of a nonprofit group in the high tech area, attorney and journalist for a quarter century.
Well, we're presently at the JFK Conference 2017 at the Crown Plaza Hotel, being produced by Judith Berry Baker. And you just spoke early this morning, I believe. And what are your views after the release of all these archives just recently?
Well, I would say the secret truth is that we're being misled again by the mainstream media, of which I've been a part for many years. They make us think that if we can't find a smoking gun, these document releases are not important. Or conversely, they confuse us by elevating trivia as distractions in the documents. Now, I track this all very closely. I administer the websites of several organizations, including Citizens for Against Political Assassinations, CAPA, of leading JFK and other researchers into assassinations, and also the Justice Integrity Project, which has reader's guides to both the JFK, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy assassinations. So I track the minutia, but here's the big picture, just as an overview, and we can dig into the details. We already know what happened in outline. So we have basically a jigsaw puzzle with a few missing pieces. But we've previously had 4 million pages of declassified documents. We have 2,500 books on this topic. We have, at a great conference like this, we have many living witnesses still living to talk about what happened. So the documents fill in part of the jigsaw puzzle, but anybody who wants to look at it knows what happened. It was a conspiracy. Oswald did not fire a fatal bullet. You can get distracted on details like who pulled the triggers, multiple triggers, what precisely his role was. I think it was largely Patsy, but people can reasonably differ on whether he knew anything or not. He was undoubtedly a government agent acting as kind of a spy in a sense. We know that. And it's disinformation to believe that in this or any other assassination, somebody is going to write an incriminating memo and then have the government release it. People do not plan assassinations by memos.
By public announcements, right? Yeah, today we're gonna assassinate JFK. Well, you really have some keen insights. Where were you on the day that JFK was assassinated, D? Can you remember back?
Well, I can, and I have two things hopefully interesting to say about it.
Okay.
One is I was in a history class at my high school in New York City, and of course we were all shocked then, and only a few years later, John F. Kennedy Jr. would attend my school. There's something poignant in that. I'm a few years older than President Kennedy's son, of course, and so I was in a high school class. The specific school is the oldest school of any kind in the United States. It's called Collegiate School. My graduating class had about 32 students or so. A year or two later, Jacqueline Kennedy would bring her son and watch our football practices in Central Park.
Oh, really? This was a very exclusive school then, was it not?
Oh, yes. So she picked that school.
But, I mean, you got a good education, didn't you?
I got a great education. But not so good that I got immediately involved in this assassination research, because as I pursued a career in first journalism and then law, like many Americans, but particularly those in the professions, let's call it, of journalism and law, I accepted the Warren Report, and I was too busy advancing my career to go beyond it until fairly recently. So even with the relationship, one step removed with the Kennedy family there, I didn't dig into it until recently. By the way, I got to tell an embarrassing story, but maybe something that I can admit after all these years. But it shows what young people are like, including young people in the media. When Jacqueline Kennedy was touring the school with the head of it, the Dean Carl Andrews, me and a couple of my friends were playing hooky from one of our last classes in the gym, and we were horsing around.
Okay.
And I had a volleyball.
Okay.
And I was playing almost like impromptu dodgeball.
Just horsing around, right?
Horsing around.
So, having a good time.
So I threw the volleyball.
Yeah.
And it suddenly, in the doorway, came the head of the school.
Oh,
with
my
Jacqueline
God.
Jacqueline Kennedy.
Really?
And the volleyball. Hold still, George.
Okay.
I don't want to do anything bad here.
Okay.
The volleyball went approximately this far from her nose.
Oh, my God. That's a surprise, wasn't it?
And here we were, having left our French class,
And how soon would that have been after the assassination?
That probably would have been 1965.
Oh, okay. So it was a couple of years after.
And she was getting a tour of the school.
Oh, I see.
And
okay.
And so she would later send John to the school.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, it was an exclusive.
If that
man
had hit her in the head, I probably would have been thrown out of the
school. Hey, Andrew, you could have changed history.
I could have. No, but so.
Well, that's an interesting story.
Well, the head of the school was not happy with me. He kind of gives me a look. And what he didn't know was that we used to set the clock ahead in our French class,
yeah,
because it was the last class before gym break, and I sometimes joke with reality that after years of French, one of the few complete sentences I knew was Monsieur le Professeur, la cloche a sonné, which means the clock has sounded, and the very dedicated teacher would look down at his notes, and he hadn't gotten through the whole plan, but he'd look up at the clock and said, well, class is over, and then we'd start horsing around. But I tell that story on myself not purely to go along with the secret truths. This is the first time I've ever told this story.
Well, that's a beautiful story.
Under your relentless interrogation.
Hey, that spices up. That spices up an interview, that's for sure.
Well, here's one other thing.
Yeah,
one of the people that I was doing it with was my co-captain in basketball, who went on to become a very famous media entrepreneur. And you just did a fist bump. Well, son, before there was a fist bump,
right,
there was a high five.
Oh, yeah,
and we like to say that we invented the high five there.
Okay.
And here's how that happened.
Okay.
Do you want to hear that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there was a great movie around that time called Breathless, starring the John Paul Belmondo. And again, my friend Robert F.X. Sillerman and I were again playing hooky, and we went and saw that movie. And when Belmondo gets out of prison, let's do a high five here.
Okay.
He's with your right hand.
My hand is sort of a bad hand.
Well, he gets out of prison after 5 years, and he goes like that.
Okay.
And so Bob Sillerman and I were co-captains of our high school basketball team.
Yeah.
And this became our gesture every time we'd go out on the town and play a game. And we had a game back in those days before sports became big time. So our high school played in Madison Square Garden before a New York Knickerbockers NBA game. And it was a doubleheader. And it had Wilt Chamberlain playing for the Philadelphia Warriors. It had the New York Knicks and all these guys, and they were playing before our high school game, Collegiate versus Fieldson. And we won that game by 1 point, high school game, and the pro players came out, and as they waited to come on, they saw us doing these.
Oh, they did. They gave.
And,
well, that's interesting.
And so we've looked it up, and there was no high five before that.
Okay.
And Bob Sillerman.
Well, y'all started that then.
Bob Sillerman
went
on to become a huge mogul. He acquired the promotion rights, among many other things, for Elvis Presley, from the Presley family, for Muhammad Ali. He was co-promoter of the most successful Broadway play, The Producers.
Okay.
He helped start the show. Drawn a blank on it. I think American Idol. And so he would be interviewed on his fabulous career in the sports and entertainment business, and he would tell the story here.
Really? That's good.
About
that's good.
The invention of the high five. So I'm jumping around, but here's something, and I've fallen into it, of where were you? And that's a great question, and I'd love to tell this story for the first time, but the important story is what actually happened,
right?
And why is it important today,
right?
And I think the psychological war experts who were very involved in these assassinations understand that we're egocentric, many of us, including, unfortunately, yours truly, and we can get diverted into the egocentric question of where were you?
Yeah.
And a friend of mine actually wrote a book about it, Gus Russo, and his entire book is Where You Were. And what that omits is what happened and what are the lies and the secret truths involved in that story.
Okay.
And the psychological warfare experts who are involved in the cover-up, and that you're and your team are fighting to this day by unveiling secret truths, they know that we get easily diverted, whether it's the high five story, the volleyball, or the nose. And the purpose of this conference, and of course your great and courageous truth telling, is what really happened. And that's that was the purpose of my talk today, to to try not to get diverted, even though we all do it, but to say this is important. They took our president and killed him in broad daylight, and we've got to help keep the public focused on that and why it's important today.
Yes, I think that's a very, very, very good statement there, and I would certainly agree with that 100%. So we're teaching the younger people, hopefully, about government and how tyrannical governments can become.
Well, yes, but it's a challenge because I'm located right now in right downtown Washington, as I've mentioned, and there's 20 million visitors a year, mostly young people, on school tours to Washington, D.C. And I recently went on some of the tours. I have some younger relatives. And I realize it's entertaining, in effect, but it's also, George, and to your audience, it's in many ways almost a propaganda.
Yes, it is. It is. It's a system of continuing a dominance of a system of thought through propaganda. To some extent.
Yes.
They mix in some truths because they have to bring the propaganda to justify the propaganda part.
And I'll just add that I've had probably about five careers in media, law, politics, and so forth. And I'll just say, for those who don't understand how it works, that, let's say 98% of the people don't, in these sectors, don't realize that they're tools of propaganda.
Yes, I understand.
It wouldn't work.
Yes, I understand.
They simply
we're controlled to a great extent by our thoughts and ideas, and we're structured by government and other institutions. So we've been institutionalized to a certain degree.
Well, exactly, and so as partly an apology for my earlier story, I'll say the relevance is here. I had this almost close contact with the Kennedy family, as I mentioned.
Okay.
And he, as a reporter covering courts, the law, as a lawyer, I wasn't involved in this because I simply assumed that the standard story was accurate. And I probably made fun of conspiracy theorists and so forth. But the press of national and current events got me about 7 years ago to start digging into this, and I've since done so with such a passion because I realize it makes a lie out of my career and that of so many others if we don't dig into this, as you've done and so many people here.
I've been on to this thing since it occurred. I didn't fully understand what was going on for years, just like yourself and others, but I eventually began to catch on. Well, I want to thank you for being with us this evening here at the JFK Conference in Dallas, Texas, 2017, and really appreciate some of your insights.
Well, George, if we have at least 20 or 30 seconds, I'd like to conclude.
Go ahead.
By what people can do.
Sure, go ahead.
Because there are very specific things that people can do. One is I've tried to do a free reader's guide to this on the justice-integrity.org website of where people can look at the books from all different perspectives, educate themselves.
And you can find that at andrewcraig.com.
Yes.
K-R-E-I-G, andrewcraig.com on the web.
That's one place.
Okay, what would be another one?
Another is the Justice Integrity site, and the other is CAPA, Citizens Against Political Assassinations, which encompasses many different...
Yeah, I worked with John Judge before up here years ago.
Well, that's great, and so,
I've had him on the program, I've forgotten what year, 2007 or 8 or something like that.
Well, we miss him so much, but here's the last and important point.
Yeah,
And again, I'm almost violating it, but... I would ask each person to be the media, and that was the concluding part of my talk just a few minutes ago. We cannot rely on the mainstream media, so we need to support programs like yours, which is actually unique, but and to spend part of our time each week doing what we can locally, at libraries, organizing events, bringing in
speakers, face-to-face.
Face-to-face.
Telling the story about what really went on.
And to advocate on social media sites like yours.
That's right. Facebook,
We are the media. Do not be waiting for some savior. I work with these people in Washington and elsewhere and have for 45 years. Most of them are clueless, as I was, and they're busy. So we've got to take the lead and be the media.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Andrew Craig, for being with us this evening.
It's my honor.
That was Andrew Craig on my interview up in Dallas last weekend. And Randall Mock went up there with me and did some good camera work. But we have this in video also. And well, if you go to thesecrettruth.com, you'll be able to go to those video sites. There's about 6 different videos that we did up there during the JFK convention conference 2017. So anyway, that's quite an interview. And coming up next, is someone that, man, I sat down with him. His name is Herbert Hubie Clark, and he had a story. He was an honor guard, He was an honor guard member that received the body up in Washington, D.C. After JFK was assassinated. And he has a really, really nice story about what went on, and I drew him out. And he does have a book called Betrayal also, and it's on the website now. So listen to that coming up right now.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're here at the JFK Conference 2017 in Dallas, Texas at the Crown Plaza. And sitting next to me, to my right, is Hubert Clark. They call him Hubie. He was part of the JFK Honor Guard on that fateful day after the president was assassinated. Hubie, tell us what are some of your remembrances on that fateful day in receiving the president there and so forth. Just tell us what happened in your own words.
Well, we showed up at Andrews Air Force Base after we were directed by the Military District of Washington that the Commander-in-Chief, President John F. Kennedy, was going to be flown in on Air Force One, and we were to remove the remains, which would be placed in a Navy ambulance and taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital for autopsy. What was so memorable about the experience at Andrews Air Force Base was when the elevator truck came down with the remains on it, along with Jackie Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and McNamara, and other dignitaries of the president's staff, was when we attempted to take the remains off the elevator truck, we were interfered with by what appeared to be you know, intelligence officers, FBI, Secret Service, CIA. We didn't know who it was. But because of the fact that they interfered, at one point, we almost dropped the casket, the bronze casket, onto the tarmac. And if other members of the honor guard weren't present, the bronze casket would have hit the tarmac and possibly could have come open. However, we were able to get it into the ambulance, and Jackie and Bobby and McNamara got into the ambulance, at which time we jumped into a helicopter and shadowed the motorcade all the way from Andrews Air Force Base to Bethesda Naval Hospital, where the autopsy was going to take place. As we neared Bethesda Naval Hospital, we sped ahead so we would be in place when the motorcade arrived. As the motorcade arrived, Jackie, Bobby, and McNamara exited the ambulance, at which time they entered the administration building, and we waited until they were inside, at which time we started to remove the president's remains. All of a sudden, a bunch of flashing lights started going off, and the ambulance took off. It just started moving forward. We were startled at first, thinking that he was going to stop, and when he didn't and kind of picked up speed, we were ordered back into the pickup truck, which brought us from the heliport. We were ordered back into the pickup truck by Lieutenant Byrd, who was in charge of the joint casket team. As we followed the Navy ambulance around the grounds, it seemed to pick up speed. Now, it was dark, it was cold.
Y'all were in a pickup truck at this time.
We were in the back of a pickup truck hanging on
for its own.
Took off on its own.
But it had the president's casket in there.
The bronze casket that was taken off Air Force One.
At the time, you didn't understand
what was going on, why it had taken off.
As this was unfolding, there was a lot of security personnel in the area.
It was an armed camp.
Yeah, okay, it was like an armed camp. And so this caused a certain amount of distractions because of this commotion that
exactly.
was going on, and it was a very serious event that was going on. So all of a sudden, this ambulance takes off on its own, and y'all are in a truck. He said, "We better follow that because they were supposed to take control of that casket."
Exactly.
We're the honor guard.
Exactly.
And we're welcoming but we're here to do our duty.
Right.
You
exactly.
have a certain military duty to
responsibility.
Responsibilities. So you felt very compelled then at that time to get in that.
It was our responsibility
to
stay with that
ambulance, right?
Stay with the remains.
I mean, they were speeding away from you. Well, what was going on? You said, "What in the heck is going on here?" Right, to yourself.
Well,
right?
We use different terminology,
right.
But you got the gist of
right,
it.
Right. Okay. So now you're driving out and following this ambulance. Okay.
At one point, the ambulance turned off the lights.
Okay, they had
tail lights.
Okay,
and the lights went out. And that's when we lost it. We lost track of it.
Now this was at night, right?
At night.
What time at night?
Oh, God.
Was it early the next morning or?
No. This was at night. This was around because it was dark already.
Oh, right.
It was dark. I would say. Around 7:15.
Okay, but it was sunset.
It was dark.
Already.
Sunset was gone.
Okay, now that means that y'all were trying to keep up with this, and all of a sudden the ambulance just cuts its
lights turned off that tail light.
And what happens next? Tell us.
We lost it.
You lost it.
We lost the ambulance.
It took off. It sped off at what kind of speed? 40, 50 miles an hour, or? It just took off with his lights on.
Well, we were going at a good clip, and we lost it.
It went fast.
It disappeared.
It disappeared, and just, okay. Now, then you're trying to find this, and you're going a circle.
We're going around in circles.
Different streets.
No, not on different streets. We went around, all the way back around to the back of the hospital.
Okay.
And started from where we started. Okay. All right, the point where we were supposed to remove roommate.
Okay.
And we came back to the front of the hospital.
Okay.
No ambulance. We went back around the same route.
Okay.
Came back around, and there was a corpsman on the loading dock, and the lieutenant yelled out from the cab, "Did you see an ambulance go by?"
Okay.
And the corpsman just threw up his arms like, "No."
Oh, okay.
And so we came back around
and the third
to the front of the hospital.
Okay,
this is the second time.
Second time, okay.
And when we made our third pass,
okay,
when we came to the back of the hospital, the ambulance was sitting there with General Godfrey McHugh standing outside.
Okay.
Godfrey McHugh was the U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff to President John F. Kennedy.
Okay. My gosh, that is the most inscrutable type of set of facts I have ever heard. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And y'all were upset by this, I'm sure.
We were cold.
You know, I mean, like, what? You know, what's going on here? And so, what? Tell us what happened after that. What?
Once we formed up, and we took the remains out of the ambulance, and we know it was the same casket because it had the same dent on the top. And on the right side of this bronze, on the top of the casket,
okay.
And on the right hand side, the handle was broken.
What created the dent?
Well, what created the dent was when they were trying to load it at Love Field.
Oh, okay.
All right.
So there was
banging it on the door and trying to go up the
door or something and cause the dent.
And caused the dent in the top and the handle to be broken on the right hand side.
That dent provided a mechanism to identify
exactly
that specific.
That's how we know it was the same.
That's why you knew that was the one.
The same casket that we had taken off the
loading dent. At Love Field was the same one that y'all were scrutinizing at this, you know.
Exactly.
So you unload the casket. And
we take it into the morgue, what we call the ante room,
okay,
which is the where they store the bodies of.
Okay. And was there anything else, another?
Nothing else. There was nothing else in the ante room.
Okay.
But we never actually went inside the inner morgue.
Okay.
All right. The doors were closed.
Okay.
And we were directed to stop right at the second set of doors.
Okay.
And we were told, all right, stand guard outside the door and make sure no unauthorized personnel comes into the into the morgue area.
Okay. And you said something earlier in our conversation before we started this interview, something other, there was another casket somewhere?
No. Well, what happened was during the night, while the autopsy was going on.
Okay, in other words, they had started at that time, you were informed, and you were guarding outside?
We were standing guard outside.
Guard outside that this autopsy had begun.
Right. Well, not quite yet, because
you had to wait for the doctor to get
individuals,
there.
Individuals or military personnel
had to arrive,
were going in and out of the autopsy.
Now, were there civilian clothes people too, like CIA and FBI?
CIA, FBI, Secret Service.
I mean, with those kind of
there
people.
Were a lot of people out there that night.
Okay, and there were top officers. Were there generals?
Generals,
colonels,
admirals.
Admirals, a bunch of people.
I don't think there were anybody below admiral and general.
I see.
And they were sitting in the gallery to the what I would say, the left, looking in, because we couldn't see them from our vantage point. However, when Admiral Berkeley...
Was there a certain place that they could look through?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, gallery teaching hospitals,
they
always have a gallery that
you
can look down that would be in close proximity.
When something is being performed
right
like that.
Where they're able
medical
to look at...
Medical students use those for teaching purposes
medical
also.
Medical students, right.
You know, so there's a place to look at and see what... Being
right, because you don't want them around the table because they can contaminate the evidence.
Yeah, right. You got to maintain a very,
sanitary area.
Because there's open, So there were just all kinds of people like that, admirals
that
and generals and so forth. And how long were y'all there on guard?
Till about 4 o'clock in the morning.
4 o'clock in the morning.
4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
But at some point, Admiral Berkeley came out of the morgue.
Right.
And naturally we were asking questions, how's it going? And he, would nod his head. And at one point, the lieutenant that was in charge of us came out of the morgue and asked us, would we like to go inside the morgue and say goodbye to the commander-in-chief? And we all declined. But at one point when Admiral Berkeley came out, we were able to look in and we could see the president from the waist up.
Oh, okay.
All right.
It was it a side view of him laying on
No,
the
no. Side? Straight ahead.
Oh, okay.
Straight ahead because we were directly outside the morgue and the second set of doors were open.
Oh, okay.
And so at that point,
but,
we all declined.
Were you looking at the top of his head? Or
no, we could see from the waist up.
But
they had
a
sheet.
View, a side view of
no,
that?
No, no. Oh. Straight forward.
Okay.
And from the waist up, he was bare from the waist up.
Oh, okay. And but at that point, you couldn't see any big.
No, they hadn't started the autopsy.
Autopsy at that point. So when did you actually leave that area around 4 o'clock?
4 o'clock
there,
in the morning.
Was there
well, prior to that,
yeah.
They had a civilian funeral home come in, funeral director come in,
right.
Because Miss Kennedy wanted the body embalmed. Normally in the military back then, there was no embalming.
Now, how about Jackie and her?
She was up on the 17th floor.
She was
on the 17th floor of the presidential suite at Bethesda Naval Hospital.
And at the top?
That's where the presidential suite is.
With her up there.
General Wheel, Bobby Kennedy, Robert McNamara.
Oh, okay.
Now, there might have been other people. We weren't, we knew about it. But at one point, the General Godfrey McHugh bought the president's blue suit that he was going to be buried in down to the morgue. He brought it in, and when he came out, he was very upset. And we kind of asked, well, you know, what's going on in there, General? But his frustration was with Lyndon Johnson because he felt that while Miss Kennedy was grieving and wanted to stay with the remains on Air Force One, he insisted that she come up and watch him get sworn in.
He was sworn in
on Air Force One.
There's a question of whether or not that was necessary. Because under the Constitution,
once the president passes away, he's automatically
becomes president. So there's a question there.
Photo op.
Yeah, he had
photo op.
Yeah, right. It could have been. It might have been. And there's that picture of Lady Bird with a very, a very
suspicious.
Look. Something like we've got it now or something. I don't know.
Neither do I. But,
well, we're from Austin. I am, and we've known those. My family knew all those people for years.
Okay.
There, you know.
You know them better than I.
Yeah, we know a lot about them. And so anyway, this is a very, very interesting story. Let me ask you another question that comes to my mind now. From the time that you delivered this bronze casket, to the facility there, and until the time that they actually said that they were performing an autopsy, what length of time would that be? What period of time?
I think they started around 8:30.
Uh-huh.
And by the time they did the embalming
When did y'all actually deliver the casket? What time would you say that it went
back to the White House?
No, into the doors of the.
No, we didn't. We never entered the inner morgue.
No,
we were stopped ante room.
When did you deliver it to the morgue? What time?
I'd say about 7:30.
Okay, now, then they told you that thing, the process started then?
Or? No, they didn't tell us, but once they closed the doors, we just assumed that they were getting ready waiting for the doctors.
But
they had
the point
a little 15-20-minute meeting.
If anything occurred, with the body, there was probably some period of time in there where there was not really an official autopsy occurring, but other things were happening. Maybe that's maybe what.
No, I agree with you. I understand.
That's highly speculative.
Yeah, no, I understand.
There's time here.
I can neither confirm or deny that nothing didn't take place.
In other words, they could be flim-flamming the time sequence here of different things to allow them to do what they
want. Outside
of any public scrutiny.
Let me just say this: that the following morning, once we had left Bethesda Naval Hospital to return the president's body back to the White House.
Okay.
All right. The chief of the day that makes all the log entries in the official military log was called down and the page was ripped out of the log because the time and the dates when everything was taking place had to be changed, and he had to change them. So in terms of something out of the ordinary, I would say that's really out of the ordinary, because you never rip out official documents.
Exactly.
You never do that. It's always a line through it with your initials.
So that would give rise to something that was really
nefarious.
Yeah, nefarious and illegal and outside of any normal procedure that they should.
There were a lot of things that were not normal.
Military procedure and record keeping and things like this that
you taught from boot camp.
Military or organization would have to keep, or any hospital. Hospitals have to keep those records because of liability and stuff like that.
Yes, absolutely.
So what after y'all went on home after that night, that early morning? And
when you say went on home, you mean to the White House?
Yeah.
We moved the remains from Bethesda Naval Hospital. We brought the president home to the White House.
You did.
And we brought him into the East Room.
Now, let me ask you this. Y'all went into the front entrance there.
Of the White House.
Pennsylvania Avenue there? Or
it was dark.
Yeah, okay.
We came through the gates.
Where did you actually end up with the remains there?
In the East Room.
In what?
In the East Room of the White House.
In the East Room of the White
right.
House. Now, it was flag draped with a flag?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And at that time, because the death watch had not been formed yet, we had to stand there and guard the casket.
So y'all substituted for the
death watch until they were formed.
And around in a certain...
As we would be carrying it on both sides of the casket. At which point, Miss Kennedy and Bobby and other family members or McNamara came into the East Room and she wanted to view the body. She wanted to view the body, and we were getting ready to march out. And she said, no, they don't have to leave. Just do an about face. So we did an about face. The casket was open, and she was able to view the body.
Okay.
It was closed. Flag placed back on.
Most of the time, except for...
All the time, except for that one instance where she wanted to view.
Who viewed the body at that time?
Her and Bobby. Her and Bobby.
Anyone else?
No.
Just those two?
Those two.
Did you hear
anything? Didn't say anything. Didn't.
Okay. Okay. Was there any kind of music or any kind of official
silence?
They've just
silence.
Silence and
silence.
The room. Okay. And how was the lighting in there? Was it subdued or what in that?
Well, the lights
the
were
lighting.
Yeah, the normal lighting. Normal lighting.
Now let me ask you this: there were Secret Service that are uniformed and not.
They were not in the room. We were the only ones in the room, along with the family.
But they were at the gates and all everything.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You both have. They have uniformed and closed Secret Service. As I understand. So, y'all were there how long then at the inside the East Room then?
I'd say we were there like maybe 45 minutes before the official death watch came.
Okay.
And they were placed around the casket, at which point we marched out.
Okay.
And we later went down on the below the level underneath the main floor where we just passed out on the carpet.
You did?
We just laid on the floor.
Oh, my God. Y'all were exhausted, weren't you?
Well, we were up from, up from 6 o'clock the following day.
Okay.
Or the previous day. And this was going on like maybe 6:30 the following morning.
Oh, okay.
So we were...
About 12.
We were kind of spent.
Something like that? Whatever. And y'all had worked?
No. 12 hours? How about 24 hours?
Oh, okay. Oh, because y'all were on duty.
Right.
In other words, y'all were...
We get up at 6 o'clock. Regularly at 6 o'clock.
Y'all were on duty and your regular work.
Right.
And then the assassination occurred, and then y'all got drawn into this because the...
All day.
Later from Dallas.
All day.
And then you continued on through the night.
Okay.
And let me ask you this. This was such an overwhelming... experience, an emotional thing, and those that either voted for him or against him, this was outside of
it wasn't politics. About politics.
It wasn't about
for the nation.
A nation.
It wasn't about politics. It was about the president of the United States being assassinated.
Right. It was about a nation which had lost
in grief, right?
In grief,
that was grieving,
and there was a real widow there, and she loved him dearly, and it was about her loss
and the children's loss.
Yes, and
they lost
so
the father
too, you know, at that time.
Camelot.
Yes, right. So, so y'all just passed out.
And well, when I say pass out, we laid down, relaxed.
I got, and then y'all went home after that.
When you say home, no, we went back to our barracks.
Oh, you went. I'm sorry.
But we didn't.
Sorry.
No, I understand.
How old were you at the time? What age were you?
I was 19.
Okay.
I was the youngest.
Okay,
I was the youngest of the entire crew.
This happened years ago. Now,
yeah, 50, I'm 73 today.
54 years ago, so it
right.
was it was a while back.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I always forget.
But I still consider myself young.
So you were a young man. So y'all went back to the barracks. Now,
right.
then, did you talk with your friends? And
didn't talk to anybody. Couldn't call anybody.
We could only go back. Put a blackout on that.
Yeah. Everybody was on, the country was on alert, because at that time...
Because they feared that the
right,
corruption...
Right, they didn't know whether it was
Cuban
a conspiracy or...
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there was an alert.
The whole country, the whole probably
military.
The whole world was on alert.
Yeah, the whole military, but it was on alert.
Right.
I mean, because of the...
No calls coming in.
Of
no calls
or
going
whatever,
out.
Or, back, you know, fighting or something. And how long was that, what did that go on, the alert for...
Until the funeral was over.
It really? Okay.
Until the funeral was over. No calls coming
now,
in.
Did y'all participate in the funeral itself? Did y'all? What?
Every time the casket moved, we moved it.
Oh, okay.
It came down to
once he left the
east room to go to the Capitol. The night before, we had to take him up the Capitol steps. We were at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at 12 o'clock at night with an empty casket with sandbags and the lieutenants sitting on top going up and down the steps.
Rehearse your
because
ceremony. Is that right?
Getting ready for those steps.
Oh, I see.
All right?
Oh.
And the fact that the casket weighed 1,300 pounds, we knew that it was going to be a struggle.
Oh, I
and the steps at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier are a little wider than the steps at the Capitol.
Oh, okay.
All right? So we wanted to be sure that there was only one person on a step at a time.
Oh,
because if one person stepped on somebody else's heel, it was over.
So y'all had to coordinate your...
Exactly.
Make sure that it was coordinated properly.
Exactly.
And then y'all buried him.
At Arlington National Cemetery. I remember my first funeral.
And there was a flame there.
Eternal flame.
Eternal flame that still is burning.
I remember my first funeral.
Yeah.
And I remember my last funeral.
Yeah.
President Kennedy was the last person I buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And I've buried close to 500 military personnel at Arlington.
My gosh. You mentioned earlier in our discussion about a shipping casket and this bronze casket. How does that figure into your story here?
While we were on the helicopter shadowing the motorcade, a black hearse pulled up at the loading dock at Bethesda Naval Hospital at 6:30 p.m.
Okay.
A silver shipping casket was taken from that black hearse by Dennis David, who was the chief of the day, and brought into the Bethesda Naval Hospital morgue and set on the floor.
Okay.
The next time a casket went in was the bronze casket that we brought in.
Right.
All right? Remember I told you there were three caskets?
Yes.
The only other casket that went in that we were aware of at the time was the African mahogany casket that came in that he was buried in.
Okay.
That's why I said three caskets.
Oh, okay.
But we knew of two. We didn't know about the shipping casket.
Now, the silver casket?
The silver shipping casket.
The shipping casket. What was that about?
They said that the president's body was taken from the silver shipping casket that arrived at Bethesda Naval Hospital morgue at 6:30 p.m. while we were still on the helicopter shadowing the motorcade to Bethesda Naval Hospital. So what I'm saying to you, in fact, is that the president's body was on the autopsy table before we even landed,
okay,
before the motorcade even arrived,
okay,
at Bethesda Naval Hospital.
So there was time in there to do things to the body then, or whatever. I mean, that would be, you know, I see. And so y'all, what y'all loaded in there was the bronze casket. Did it, when y'all picked it up from the plane, did it feel like it had something in it, or?
Well, remember what I said.
Yeah.
When we were dragging it off the elevated,
yeah,
truck.
Okay.
We were ambushed, or we were.
Oh, I see.
By,
yeah,
the civilians.
You said that.
But
yeah,
looking back.
Yeah.
52 years later.
Right.
You know, we all came to the, yeah, same conclusion.
Yeah.
Whether or not they, in fact, didn't want us to touch that casket.
Oh, I see. I see. I got you. So that would give rise to possibly an empty casket, what could have been. But now, his body...
We don't want to speculate,
but... body would weigh... Let me ask you this. His body would weigh maybe 200 pounds or something,
no,
2 1/4, or...
I'd say
maybe
one... No, no.
180?
No, about 175, okay, 165, something
now,
in that order.
What would be the overall weight of that bronze casket?
Well, it would all depend on...
1,000 pounds? No?
No, no. It would all depend on the make...
Oh, and
the
material.
And, yeah,
no,
and
right,
it always comes,
okay,
down to the affordability of who's,
okay,
paying,
okay,
for it.
Right.
Exactly. So,
okay,
you can get a beautiful heavy casket, and you can get a beautiful light casket,
right,
depending upon who's being buried.
Right.
You know, how much money do you want to spend?
Right.
But in this case, the government was footing the bill, and the family said, we want the best that you have.
Right.
And that's why the mahogany casket was bought from Gullah's funeral home. But mind you, in Dallas,
right,
that was also a private casket that was bought from a funeral home to Parkland Hospital. That was not a shipping casket. That was a bronze ornamental casket.
There's another one?
No.
No, the
bronze, no,
that y'all...
That they put him in at Parkland,
oh, okay,
Hospital.
Okay. So the value of what your experience was that there's different things, different caskets showing up at different times from different funeral homes and so forth, and this cast a light that there was some manipulation going on, or highly, you know what I mean,
one might think that.
Yeah, right. So today, how would you conclude your this interview? What would be your closing comments in this interview today? And we have him, A Betrayal is his book. It can be found on YouTube.
Amazon.
On Amazon. And also, do you have a site on this? Do you have a website?
No, I don't, because I don't want any hate mail.
But you'll find people that have read it and they've reported it very well.
Oh.
They've reviewed it well for you. So Amazon has it, so go in there and find that.
If I had one thing to say about my experience back then...
Yeah, tell us a conclusion here, concluding remarks.
In the years following that traumatic time, it would be that... The country was grieving. The country was in a state of shock. And that we were told that one person shot the President of the United States, that he was a lowlife, that he was a drifter, that he was a communist sympathizer. Having been in law enforcement for 22 years and visiting Dealey Plaza and standing on that X and looking back at the school book depository, ask questions as to why, how, and who was responsible. Not just a matter of reading my book, but never shut yourself down from learning what took place. I don't know whether we'll ever know, if we're still talking about Lincoln's assassination. I dread to think that it's going to take that long for the American people to really find out what happened on November 22nd, 1963, when the President of the United States was assassinated by people in, around the United States of America. Thank you very much for the interview.
Hubert Clark, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
That was Hubie Clark with his detailed first-person description. And there were all kinds of irregularities about, you know, caskets of different makes and colors and everything else. We just hope to give you some of these background details that maybe you haven't ever heard of before. And you know, some of these things, I didn't know there was a viewing gallery inside the mortuary there when it was, autopsy was being conducted and so forth. So, I mean, there are things like that we uncover as we go along, you know. But it's a learning process. But Hubie Clark is a really fine person. He went into law enforcement afterward. He spent 22 years in law enforcement. And he's really a stand upright man. We've got, like I said, if you go into thesecrettruth.com, you'll find his website there. Getting back to the first, interview there, you're going to find Andrew Craig. And Andrew Craig is quite a commentator, quite an educator, doctorate, you know, he's got law degrees and everything else. But he's worked in consumer and ethic issues in Washington, D.C. His office, he said, is on Pennsylvania Avenue. So he's in the heart of the so-called swamp up there, you know. And he knows how difficult it is to try to drain the swamp. The JFK assassination showed what these conniving, conspiratorial people can do. And they can take down anyone, and they did. Kennedy presented a lot of problems to them. Kennedy wanted to establish a detente with the Soviet Union. They didn't want that. They wanted an arms race. So, you know, the Allen Dulles connection, the General Cabell, his brother was the mayor of Dallas. I mean, it just reads like a who's who, you know, in Wax Museum. But it was all really conniving and conspiratorial. And they finally took him out because he got in their way. Big economic interests were the people. And there, I think at the end of his, interview, Andrew Craig says the top, he named them all the alphabet companies did it, you know. Hubie Clark, though, on the second interview here, has some really personalized things to say. He made some very poignant comments, I thought, at the very end of that interview. But anyway, I want you to go back, and we've got, this is the first hour, and then we're going to be coming back with a second hour that follows this, and we're going to have Jim Fetzer and Larry Rivera interviews on the second hour. And so anyway, want to thank you for listening. We certainly appreciate all the loyal listeners we have out there and all the people. I get some very encouraging comments when I meet many of y'all out there in the public. And I think Charlotte's up there at some turkey dinner. I think one of her families up there is having a big, big turkey dinner today. So she's tied up, bless her soul, and she's doing great. I just want to thank everyone for listening. And okay, just keep up all the hard work, and we're in there trying to do our best. We're not going to give up by any chance. Thank you for listening. God bless you.